This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Anthony Brooks in Washington. Neil Conan is away. If you haven't heard about it, then you must be living off-planet somewhere. If you're not doing it, then you're probably over 50. We're talking about online social networking, websites that allow people to connect with each other, establish friendships, share pictures, music, videos, or even discuss their work, or even their dogs and cats. The best known have names like MySpace, Facebook, and LinkedIn. But there are others with names like Elder Voice and Dogforia, among hundreds of others. Online social networks used to be the territory of people in high school or college, but that's not the case anymore. Parents, working professionals, CEOs are now Facebooking and MySpacing. So are politicians. Hillary Clinton claims more than 52,000 friends on her MySpace page. We want to hear from you. Are you using online communities like Facebook or MySpace? How do they help you connect? And do you feel more connected or just more glued to the computer screen? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org, and you can comment on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. And we're going to begin this segment with Andy Carvin. Andy is NPR's senior strategist for online community, and he joins us here in the studio. Andy, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you.
Thanks.
For those listeners who might not be really up to speed with this, social networking, give us a sense of how a typical social network works.
When you go to a social network for the first time, typically the first thing they ask you to do is create a profile for yourself. The idea behind that is they want you to establish a presence on the site where people can learn a little bit about you. It might involve posting a picture of yourself, talking about your interests, where you live, things like that. And then after that, there are usually opportunities for you to dive into different types of discussion forums or upload original media you've created, like photos or videos and the like. Sites like Facebook, for example, when you create your profile, you will often join a network that you're associated with. So, for example, if you went to a particular university, like I went to Northwestern University, if I can verify that I have a Northwestern alumni address, I'm allowed to join that particular group. And so once you're in there, you're given access either to a niche group of people affiliated around some particular shared interest or experience, or a broader community where people are just there because they want to socialize, talk about things that are going on. And so there's a wide variety of types of social networks out there depending on what you're looking for, but they share those basic attributes.
Okay. So how popular are they? Do we have any idea of how many people are actually doing this?
Well, if you look at young people today, it's extraordinarily popular. The National School Boards Association came out with a study just a couple of months ago, and according to their surveys, just over 70% of teenagers go to a social networking site at least once a week, which is an extraordinary number. And if you look at the broader population, even though they still tend to skew somewhat young, we're still talking about millions and millions of adults as well as young people. MySpace claims to have over 20 million accounts on it. Facebook, which is one of the other large social networks, has upwards of 40 million. And these aren't just U.S. phenomena as well. You've got people all over the world, but particularly in places where there's a lot of broadband internet access.
Now, let's talk, because I know that the sort of fabric of these online communities is different and varied, but let's talk for a minute about MySpace.
Sure.
This gives folks an opportunity to sort of connect, to network with each other. How does that work? And how is it different, say, than just my address book on Microsoft Outlook, for example?
Well, if you start with just your address book and Outlook, what you're looking at is a passive contact list. It doesn't do anything, it doesn't go anywhere, and it doesn't bring anyone to you. You have to actively go out of your way to reach out to all of those people. With a social network, you create a presence that's publicly accessible, and the list of people you become friends with or contacts with is also publicly accessible. So those folks all have the ability to interact with each other as well in one level or another. In the case of MySpace, when that site first launched, it really focused around music, and so people would form together around bands they like, songs they like. And then once users were able to start creating profiles of themselves, literally claiming their space, hence the name MySpace, they could identify the types of music they like and interact with people who share those similar tastes. And then suddenly you had this phenomenon of millions of kids all over the country identifying each other as friends, even though they've never met each other or had any real connection with each other, apart from the fact that they either like that type of music or they just like the picture that you happen to have of yourself online. So in some senses, the kind of interactions that sometimes take place in these social networks can be seen as somewhat shallow, even flirtatious at times. But then other types of social networks like LinkedIn and Facebook often have people who are gathering together around very shared particular interests or professional groups. And so I have probably 300 contacts in Facebook, most of whom are professional contacts of mine. And so when I'm working on a project and I need to ask my peers about their opinion on that subject, I'll often post the question to Facebook. And often within a matter of minutes, I'll start getting responses from people.
And do you find yourself doing that sort of on a daily basis, hourly basis? I mean, it's something you rely on as a working tool.
I check Facebook half a dozen times a day, I would say. And other tools that I use, like Twitter, which is a type of social network, but it's accessible through text messaging and instant messaging as well as on the web, there's constant casual contact in it. And so people will send things to me in the same way they would an instant message, but it ends up being a large group conversation. So for example, right before coming on air today, I posted a note on my Twitter account saying, is there anything I should talk about in particular when I'm on Talk of the Nation today? And immediately I got a whole bunch of responses from people saying, oh, you should be sure to talk about the history of email discussion lists, or you should talk about this social network. And so immediately peers all over the place had opinions that they wanted to share because they were part of that contact group of mine.
So you're really talking about the creation of a sort of collective intelligence almost.
That's exactly what it is. And it's whatever you make it to be. If you use it in a very casual, informal way, it may not be anything more than very shallow acquaintances. But if you use it in a more constructive way and in a more focused way and make contacts with people who have shared professional interests or hobbies, then you're more likely to get more productive activity out of it.
We're talking to Andy Carvin. He's NPR's senior strategist for online communities, and we're talking about online communities. Do you use them? Do you depend on them? And give us a call, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Let's go to Lori, who's calling from Washington. Hi, Lori.
Hi.
You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
Good. Hey, I just had a comment. I recently started using MySpace myself. I'm not a teenager. I'm 39 years old. I'm not on there looking for new people. I'm using it to connect with old friends, and I found that I'm actually using MySpace much the same way I used to use email.
Interesting. All right, Lori. Well, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Andy, how typical is that, using these networks to really go back and contact old friends or, you know, maybe what, people you went to high school with, for example?
Well, it's funny that she uses that example because, frankly, that's the only reason I use MySpace anymore. For me personally, I don't find myself really getting into a lot of the conversations that take place there. A lot of the contacts I get seem to be very informal and a little too shallow for my own taste. But at the same time, once in a blue moon, maybe three or four times a year, I'll hear from someone through MySpace that I knew in elementary school. And so I maintain a profile in MySpace solely for that purpose at this point. And otherwise, my professional contacts tend to take place in sites like Facebook and Twitter and a few others because the level of community organizing that takes place there is just more attuned to the type of needs I happen to have at the moment.
And this phenomenon of community organizing, I mean, this is really a global phenomenon. I wonder if you could tell us about takingitglobal.org. This is an example, really, of the power to bring people together across the planet.
Sure. Taking It Global isn't exactly a household name when it comes to social networks, but it's actually one of the oldest social networks out there. They started almost 6 years ago at this point, creating an online community where young people, mostly late high school and college age, from around the world can get together and work together on global policy issues. And they've organized it in such a way so that you can participate either based on the issue you care about, like AIDS or poverty alleviation, or about the region you care about. So if you're from Ghana, for example, you can immediately network with all the other Ghanaians in the group, whether they're actually in Ghana or they're in the Ghanaian diaspora. And they've gotten so good at collaborating and talking about policy issues that they've actually collaborated over the years with the United Nations whenever the UN has had certain types of global summits related to internet policy, AIDS, and other issues. They've turned to taking it global to help them organize effectively a youth caucus in which they go and reach out through their communities to target members in different countries to get a sense of how they would respond to certain policy issues. They come up with recommended solutions, and sometimes they'll share them with the local governments, and the governments will actually pass on those recommendations, or they'll present those policy recommendations directly through the UN meetings. And so it's a really tangible way of looking at how young people are using social networks in a real positive way.
What about abuse within social networking? Let's talk about some of the dangers. For example, you told me earlier in the day that you started a site called Stop Cyberbullying. First of all, explain what cyberbullying is and why this site became necessary.
Sure. Cyberbullying is basically bullying that takes place on the internet, as the name would suggest. You know, in the old days when kids would get bullied in school, it would be because someone would harass them in the locker room or bother them right off campus. Nowadays, it's easy for a student who wants to bully someone to set up a really nasty page about them in MySpace or to start sending things out through email discussion groups and the like. And once things are posted online, it's next to impossible to take it down. And so young people find that when they're being harassed, they can't get away from it. It follows them wherever they go as long as they have access to digital communications tools. And so I happen to run an education blog for PBS. And so as part of my activities with that, I decided to create my own private social network called Stop Cyberbullying, in which teachers and parents would be invited to share their best thinking as well as lesson plans on how to deal with the issue. And then about a month ago, Wired magazine decided to run a comedy article in which they called the 6 lamest social networks on the internet. And some of them were actually kind of funny. They went after a social network that was for Star Trek fans, for Trekkies, for example. But then they mentioned the Stop Cyberbullying group and basically said the folks who joined this group are a bunch of wimps who can't take it. And they didn't actually use the word wimps, but I don't want the FCC getting on our back, so I'm not going to use the word that they used. And I found out about this because suddenly members of the group were emailing me late one night saying, we've got to do something. We're being harassed by vandals all over the place. And literally people were coming in into the woodwork from all over the place because they saw an opportunity to attack people. So the very mentioning of this social network by Wired caused this group to be bulleted, and we've actually had to lock it down, and now we vet every member before they join.
All right, Andy. Well, Andy Carvin, NPR Senior Strategist for Online Communities, you've put a lot on the table to talk about. We're talking about social networking. Most of us know the big sites like Facebook and MySpace, but can you really be friends with 3,000 people? We'll talk about that next and get more of your calls at 800-989-8255, or you can send us an email. The address is talk@npr.org. I'm Anthony Brooks. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Anthony Brooks in Washington. For a long time, social networks got a bad rep with worries about safety and most adults complaining they were just a waste of time. But that's changing. By their own count, Facebook has some 40 million users, Black Planet around 16 million, and MySpace says they have around 200 million accounts right now. That's a lot of people, and it's not just kids. So let us know, are you using any of these online communities? Do they help you connect or just keep you glued to the computer screen? The number is 800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org. Our guide to social networking today is Andy Carvin. He's NPR's Senior Strategist for Online Communities, and he's here in the studio. Also joining us now in the studio is Christine Rosen. She's the Senior Editor at the New Atlantis Journal and a Resident Fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. She's the author of the article Social Networking and the New Narcissism in this month's New Atlantis Journal, and she joins us here in the studio as well. Christine Rosen, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
The title of your piece refers to the new narcissism, and let me just start right there with a title that seems like a sort of provocative title. How does social networking express or encourage narcissism?
Well, I think one of the things that we should look at when we talk about creating profiles on these sites is how the technology itself forces us to present ourselves. I mean, there are limited options. And the currency on social networking sites, whether you're using them for personal entertainment or for professional connections, is exposure of information. You have to tell a lot about yourself. You're supposed to post pictures of yourself. Everything about the technology encourages revelation and exposure. So that's the starting point for these technologies. It's not necessarily a bad thing, but since we don't have a lot of data on how people are actually using these networks, are they really using them more for professional purposes, or are they using them for entertainment, for a kind of cyber voyeurism? We're not sure yet. There are new studies that are being done right now to look at those questions, but I think the new narcissism was meant to be provocative. It was meant to have us pause for a moment and question how these sites change our real world behavior, not only by the opportunity cost of how much time we're spending on them, but how they're encouraging us to present ourselves in the virtual space.
You write that it also has big... We're just now coming to grips with the consequences of all this on friendship, privacy, authenticity, community, and identity. Let's talk about some of those. What about the idea of friendship? I mean, a lot of these sites talk about friends, thousands of friends that you can sort of connect with and be connected to.
It's true. In fact, all of the names and slogans of these sites emphasize that they're a way to make friends, meet friends. Friendster's name speaks for itself. But I think rather than emphasizing the cultivation of friendship, they emphasize collection. And I think what that gets us to is a bigger point about a lot of these networks and how a lot of people are using them, is that the collection of friends is not an effort to reach out and meet more people. It's an effort to exhibit a certain form of status online. So if you have 1,000 friends, obviously, these aren't the same as your flesh and blood friends that you see face to face and that you have a connection to. Nevertheless, it does sort of feed a deeply felt human need for status. I mean, it does show, look at how important I am. I can have all of these friends. And that's why we also have services like friendflood.com, where you can purchase fake friends for your MySpace and Facebook pages if you want to do that. Now, are most people doing that? Probably not. But I think it's another example of how the technology itself is structured in a way to encourage the collection rather than the cultivation of friendship.
Andy, do you want to chime in on this at all? I mean, this idea that these aren't real friends. This is really about status and the collection of friends in these communities.
I think the use of the word friend on some of these sites can be very misleading. I tend to prefer sites that use the term contact, or perhaps gives me the choice, like on the photo sharing site Flickr. Every person you connect with is a contact, but then you can upgrade them to friend or family as well, which is nice to show that for certain people, but also gives them different privileges. And so if you want privacy for family photos, for example, people may be your contacts, but then they don't have access to them. But you definitely see these trends on many social networks where a certain percentage of users seem to go out of their way to have these enormous lists of friends, because in some cases, the social network will let you show who's quote-unquote most popular or who's hot right now. And those are tabulated based on the number of friends or the speed in which people are getting friends. And so it ends up becoming a contest for certain folks. And so it's pretty regular that I get contact requests or friend requests on Facebook from people I've never heard of. And so I've made a practice of immediately going, checking their profile, seeing who they are in terms of what their resume says there, seeing if we have any shared contacts. And if I'm not particularly sure, I'll shoot them an email and say, hey, do we know each other? There was a time when I was a bit more open about it and would let people become my contact left and right. But after a while, it does seem to get a little silly and a little arduous dealing with all this information. And so you kind of have to make a concerted effort to select carefully whom you consider a friend or a contact and whom you don't.
Well, we've got lots of listeners waiting patiently to get on this conversation. So let's go to some of them. Let's go to Jeremy, who's calling from San Francisco. Hi, Jeremy.
Hi, how you doing?
Very well. You're on the air.
I'm calling because I actually have seen, I mean, speaking of the friends, you know, it requires a connection. And I started an online community called, for multiple sclerosis patients, called KnowMS.com, KNOW. And there you immediately have the connection. And it's just the power of the internet to reach a very specific audience who happens to be spread out all over the world.
And give us some sense of what you've heard from this community. I mean, what kind of community is connecting here?
So the community, you know, I put entries on the community. People comment on those entries. You know, it's a way to share treatment information. You know, it's a way to share stories, success stories, failures, and, you know, just general coping with the disease. But and also a way to spread, you know, information. I had a hard time finding patient perspectives when I was diagnosed, and so this provides just that I mean, this is all patients, you know, writing their experience about this disease, not an expert, not a doctor. These are patients.
Well, Jeremy, thanks so much for the call.
All right, thank you.
I appreciate it. Let's go to Ann, who's calling from Cleveland, Ohio. Hi, Ann.
Yes, hi. While I was waiting, similar thoughts that I was having came up in the discussion. What bothers me, and I hope I can say this succinctly, is the virtual world of the Internet and these sites and how they appeal to ego and self-centeredness in this world, and how they replace the development of real contacts, real community, real friendships in life is disturbing when you think that young people who are supposed to learn that in the context of life are learning it in the context of the Internet, and in so doing, probably are warping their understanding of what it is like to do this in reality, and their worlds are more virtual than real. And I taught for 35 years, and I am concerned about this. They develop a humongous ego. They walk around with the inflection patterns. There's not one girl, I can't imagine one girl that I've heard speak in the last, 10 years that doesn't have that voice in the mouth and, you know, like that, and drives me crazy.
All right, Ann, I think you've put a lot of good points on the table. Yeah, we absolutely get the point. I want to get Christine Rosen.
Yeah, that would be good.
It seems like Ann is echoing some of the concerns you raise in your piece.
I think her point is very well taken, and especially because she's talking about a younger generation. I think for all of us sitting around here of a certain age who join social networks as an adult, we have a different perspective. We have a different set of norms and a better understanding of boundaries, I think, perhaps, than kids who are raised on this. The kids I've interviewed, including many of our interns at the Journal, talk about it in the way that Anne just described. Every single etiquette challenge you have as a college freshman is exacerbated in the virtual world and different in the virtual world. Someone sends you an invitation to be a friend. You don't want this person to be your friend. What's the etiquette on how to turn them down? I think it's also worth noting that this entering freshman at NYU this year were offered a little seminar called Facebook in the Flesh, because what a lot of professors and administrators at that university had noted is that they were having a hard time with freshmen having face-to-face social conversation. So the Facebook in the Flesh course was offered, and the New Yorker wrote a little piece about it. The comic or tragic thing about it is that at the end of the little course, where they just made, you know, common chit-chat, which you would take for granted, several of the students admitted that they thought it was a lot harder than Facebook. Because on Facebook, you know everything instantly about a person rather than learning through a process of gradual revelation, which is what more old-fashioned friendship is like. So I think her concerns are quite valid.
Andy, do you want to chime in on some of the points that Anne raised?
I often hear people concerned about online communities undermining real-world community. And what I've noticed is I've been using online communities since about 1984 when I was 13 years old and got access to a bulletin board. I grew up near NASA in Central Florida, and so there were a lot of NASA geeks setting up Dungeons & Dragons discussion groups and the like. So I got inculcated in this stuff really early on and then started doing it professionally in the early mid-90s. And what I've observed over that time is the discussions that took place in online communities in the late 70s, 80s, and into the early 90s tended to have more of a local focus to them, things like The Well, Cleveland Freenet, and the like. And then suddenly, as the Internet became more common, there was a lot of emphasis on how you could suddenly interact with a person halfway around the globe. And so people started communicating and forming communities of interest, and physical communities seemed less and less important. But I'm starting to feel that there's a shift coming back towards geographic communities as well, because it's so easy for people to set up their own community now. They're sitting back and thinking, well, what communities do I really care about? What's worth creating an online community around? And so they're creating things such as groups related to cancer patients in a particular town, or people who want to get together and work on an environmental issue. And so it's very locally focused on for local concerns and local challenges. And so, sure, you still have these major challenges with young people who have grown up in a culture that's not just the online world, but just the whole zeitgeist of the last 15 years in which we tend to focus on me, me, me. It's exacerbated by what goes on online in some cases, but it certainly wasn't created by it. But I'm still hopeful that we're going to see more people using these tools in productive ways, especially ones that address local issues.
Here's an email from a listener named Stephanie. I'm a high school teacher, and some of my students asked me to set up a Facebook account. I did, but I was so embarrassed by the raunchy things some of my students were posting that I deleted the account. Do your guests know of any school policies that regulate faculty use of these sites? Before we get to school policies, Christine Rosen, I mean, this sort of gets to the issue that one of the issues that you bring up in your article, and that is norms of behavior on these sites. We're still sort of making them up as we go along, in a way.
I think that's absolutely right. The other thing to note about these social networking sites is that in order to stand out, with so many people on them, in order to stand out, the level of vulgarity and or coarseness is ratcheted up, at least among a younger generation, which is very carefully calibrating their online persona anyway. So there's a wonderful technology observer named Jaron Lanier who said, you know, if the Emperor Augustus had a MySpace page, it'd feature him picking his nose. I mean, because this is what would stand out. And I think that there's a large element of truth to that, especially in how younger generations are using these sites. So yeah, I think we're trying to work on developing new norms. And the educators are really on the front line of this, especially high school teachers.
We're talking to Christine Rosen, senior editor at New Atlantis Journal, and Andy Carvin, NPR senior strategist for online communities, about online networking. And you can join the conversation by giving us a call at 800-989-8255-989-TALK. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let me just read two emails back-to-back with two different points of view. The first one is from California Secretary of State Deborah Bowen. I use Facebook's status updates to help people understand what the California Secretary of State actually does from day to day, and I think people really appreciate it. I manage my own page, so it is really me. It creates a unique kind of accessibility, and I especially like connecting with young people on Facebook. Here's an email from Jill. I don't like social networking. There's no way to be real or authentic when communicating via a computer screen. It's all about self-promotion. That's why it makes the most sense for use by those who truly are promoting themselves, either because they are in a band or they sell homemade oven mitts. I miss the good old days when computers were for dorks. Now I'm a dork because I don't go to MySpace. So there are a couple of different points of view. And I'd like to bring in a couple of callers. Let's go to Fiona, who's calling from Portland, Oregon. Hi, Fiona.
Hi. I'm a community manager online, and I wanted to say about adults getting online, one of the great things that you can find online is for moms who, you know, if their child's sick, they can talk to other moms and find out what they've been through and get natural solutions for it or cheaper solutions. And that, I've seen a real advantage for, you know, older people. I wanted to comment, though, I'm 23 years old, and I think that the computer and social networking has definitely affected my abilities socially.
How so? How have they affected your abilities socially?
Well, I used to be in customer service, and I remember a time where, you know, going around, I wasn't afraid of people. I didn't feel like anybody was out to get me, but after being online on social networks so much, where people can say anything, they can be whoever they are, and, you know, they'll say mean things, they'll post mean things, they're really, people get very, there's a mob mentality that goes on online a lot, and, you know, it's changed my perception of people and who they really are, as opposed to who they pretend to be face-to-face, and so I think that is a real downfall, and I think I see people my age, you know, with the same problems, where they just can't talk to people face-to-face anymore.
Hmm. Very interesting call, Fiona. Thanks for it. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Let's go to Brooke, who's calling from Kansas. Hi, Brooke.
Hi. I'm originally from Ethiopia, and I've lived here for 3 years, but since I've created my Facebook account about 6 months ago, I have a lot of friends, my high school friends that have moved here from Ethiopia as well, and are in different states at this time, and I can connect with them and see what they're doing on my Facebook. And also kids I went to school with in Ethiopia that are still back home, that they can post pictures up on there, and I can keep up with what they're doing without having to deal with expensive phone calls back home. And also, now that I can get it on my cell phone, I don't have to waste my time at work going to a different page on my web browser. I can check my mobile.
All right, Brooke. Well, Brooke, we appreciate it. There's a good call in favor of a sort of keeping a global community intact. What about, though, Andy, this concern, young people in particular, spending way too much time just glued to their computer screens? I mean, there is a concern there.
Yeah. I'd actually like to tie that to one of the callers that came in a little while ago asking about education policy. I think one of the big issues that we face is that we hear a lot of people complaining about MySpace. There's a lot of controversy around it. And frankly, MySpace has created that controversy because no one was minding the store for such a long time. It developed a reputation of being a place where parents weren't around, they weren't welcome, so kids could do whatever they want and have the rule of the house. And so because of that, parents and educators get this impression that all social networks are like that all the time. And what we seem to be lacking are lesson plans and curriculum in which we're actually teaching responsible use of social networking. And I'm not talking about how to avoid online predators and the like, but how to behave online, how to comport yourself, what kind of information should really be private and what shouldn't, and what kind of permanence there is to certain things you post online as well. And unfortunately, a lot of schools actually end up blocking all types of social networks, so we don't get a chance to do that kind of education.
We're going to talk more about how people use these social networking sites in a moment, plus a case of dark humor that went viral long before the internet, why the Sharks of Africa petitioned against the abolitionist movement. We'll explain. I'm Anthony Brooks. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. But right now, we're wrapping up our conversation about some of the ways people use social networking sites. We're joined by Andy Carvin. He's senior strategist for online communities here at NPR. And Christine Rosen, she wrote the article Social Networking and the New Narcissism in this month's New Atlantis Journal. And Christine Rosen, let me come to you really quickly to start this section off. What are studies telling us, the few studies that are out there about the effects on people using online communities like this?
Well, there was one out of Brigham Young University, very small study, only about 148 respondents, so it shouldn't be taken as indicative of large-scale trends. But what it found was that very heavy users of social networking sites, and these we're talking about MySpace and Facebook, that they felt much less connected to their communities, which I think is ironic. I mean, the whole idea of connecting online is supposed to encourage community. And I think some of the points that Andy has made about smaller local communities or special interest communities has shown that. But in terms of using social networking as entertainment or for connection, we find it does draw people away from real-life communities and engagement with them.
Let's go to a caller. Kelly is calling from Texas. Hi, Kelly. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing?
Very well, thank you.
Good. I'm calling because at my university, we had an education major who actually got in trouble for her profile on Facebook or either MySpace. And also the school districts here have companies that go out online and actually view MySpace and Facebook to see if potential employees have a profile on there and what kind of pictures they're looking for. And they're looking at the pictures. Are you sitting at a table with a bottle of wine or a bottle of beer? These are the things that they're looking for, and they look for things that are quote-unquote unethical for future teachers. And like I said, a classmate of mine had gotten in trouble for that.
Hmm. All right, Kelly, well, thanks for the call. Christine, what does that tell you, that kind of use of these online communities by potential employers, by other people sort of fishing around and trying to figure out what's really going on?
I think it's a reminder, especially to a younger generation, which has a very different understanding of privacy than I think older generations, that everything you put online should be treated as if it's going to be on the front page of the New York Times, because everything you put out there about yourself is potentially viewable. Now, of course, there are privacy settings on these websites, but as Andy mentioned earlier, a lot of people aren't cautious and careful about what they will reveal, and especially among college students, there seems to be an almost Victorian notion of privacy where they want to cordon off parts of themselves. So if they have pictures of themselves, you know, at a keg party, they don't think that their potential employer should count that against them when they submit their application.
Well, here's an email from Kevin P. Hello, I'm an information technology person in the Silicon Valley, and I hate social network sites like LinkedIn. I'm constantly getting invitations from sales and marketing people who want to use it as a route to glean leads. Who I associate with is my business. Technologies such as this are a net negative, in my opinion. Andy, how can people like Kevin P. sort of defend themselves against this kind of intrusive behavior?
Vigilance, really. There's no way you can completely cut it off, because when you join a social network, typically what happens is the network will email you or contact you in some way when a person wants you to become their contact. Recently, a colleague of mine actually coined the term bacon to describe this. So it's not truly spam. It's stuff you want, but you don't necessarily want that kind of contact right now. And in many cases on some of these networks, the kind of contacts you get tend to be more marketing oriented. And after a while, you just learn to be vigilant about tuning them out. And unfortunately, for those folks who are doing these types of marketing, they're not often very good at showing who they are, except as marketers. And so it doesn't take me very much time to recognize that the person who's trying to contact me really has no connection with me whatsoever. And so until they actually get better at that, I actually find it fairly straightforward. But it does take a certain amount of time to manage this this stream of bacon that does come your way.
Here's an email from Carla in Arizona. I use MySpace to check on my little sister's profile. She's 16. I'm only 23, but not a huge fan of the whole social networking thing. It can consume a lot of a person's time. My parents have no idea about it, and I wanted to make sure she was using the internet wisely and not posting inappropriate or personal information. For instance, we had to make her change her name, location, and set her profile to private. Christine Rosen, this reminds me of a sort of anecdote in your article about a sort of MySpace romance that kind of broke up publicly. Tell that story, because it does sort of create this issue of privacy.
This was Facebook. Two college students who were early adopters of Facebook. They were in college when Facebook started, and they dated for a while. And so, you know, this is one of the new etiquette challenges for college students. And I've talked to many young men who've said they get huge pressure from a woman they've taken on three dates because she wants you to change your relationship status immediately to involved, and maybe you're dating several other women at the same time, and that might make things a little bit difficult. This couple, though, eventually got engaged, so they both updated their status to engaged, and a little Facebook news feed went out, and everybody, you know, sent them congratulatory notes and, you know, posted messages on their walls. Well, then they split up. And she had just started to tell a few friends and close family members, but he did the very 21st century thing. He changed his relationship status on Facebook from engaged to single. And Facebook sent out a feed to every one of his friends, as well as to many of whom were hers. And so there in her inbox was a little message that said, Mr. X has ended his relationship. There is a timestamp, 9:45 a.m., and a little broken heart icon. And, you know, when I talked to her about it later, she said it wasn't the fact that people found out, because she assumed people would find out eventually. It was the fact that everyone found out instantaneously and through this technological medium rather than in face-to-face conversation with her.
And before perhaps she was ready to sort of go public with this news.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you both for coming in very much. Christine Rosen, thank you.
Thank you.
Christine Rosen is the senior editor at the New Atlantis Journal, a resident fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. Her article, Social Networking and the New Narcissism, is in this month's New Atlantis Journal. She joined us here in Studio 3A. And Andy Carvin is NPR's senior strategist for online communities. Andy, thanks for being a guide on online communities and networking for us today. Thanks
very much. My pleasure. Thanks.